Welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, your audio source for what's going on in the Chicago theater scene. This is the episode for March 16th, 2009, and on this week's episode we have an interview with Robert Falls and Greg Allen. Also, we have Chicago's theater news for you, so get ready, and let's talk theater.
This is the Talk Theater in Chicago interview podcast. I'm your host, Ann Nicholson Weber. And today I'm talking to Robert Falls, who is the artistic director at Goodman, and Greg Allen, founding director of the Neo-Futurists. And we're here to talk about the O'Neill Festival at Goodman, which has just closed, but still has people talking, including us. So welcome, both of you. Greg is here because he directed Strange Interlude as part of the festival. And that was, I think, the last show.
It was the crowning achievement of the... it was the last final production, final three performances devoted to the festival this past weekend were Greg's production of Strange Interlude.
So maybe you could tell me, Bob, how that production was conceived. Was it... Did you know you wanted to do the play and you looked for Greg? Had Greg mentioned he wanted to do it?
No, it's a long story about putting the festival together, but from the beginning, I knew I wanted to include Chicago companies. I thought that was essential to the production and of the festival. And the entire concept of the festival was not just a celebration of a particular playwright, something which we've done in the past with August Wilson. But to look at a playwright in depth, which we have done with writers like Edward Albee and David Mamet in particular, writers very much still with us, writers with a significant body of work and writers that we thought would be valuable to look at them in a sort of deeper context of their work. O'Neill was a special and separate occasion. He's my favorite American writer, and I've devoted a lot of time and energy to him. I knew that I would be directing this production of Desire Under the Elms. And I was struggling as an artist, and have been, with how do you direct the work of this genius, I believe, who was formed in the 19th century. He was born in the 19th century. His influences were his father, who was a great 19th century actor, the melodramas of the 19th century, as well as the modernism of Nietzsche and Ibsen and Strindberg. And then this artist, I believe, created the serious modern American theater in the 20th century. And here we are in the 21st century, and what does it mean? Mm-hmm. You know, is it still valid? Is he old-fashioned? Is he avant-garde? You know, what is he now in the 21st century? And it's an issue I was sort of struggling with. How do you perform his works in the 21st century? So I knew that I wanted to surround myself with a number of artists who I felt would be like-minded explorers. And that included some European artists, but it also included Chicago artists. And I specifically have been a great fan of Greg's work and the work of the Neo-Futurists, as well as Sean Graney and the Hypocrites. And I thought that these were two companies and two particular directors who might relish the opportunity. I didn't really know in advance what their enthusiasm or their feelings about O'Neill were. So it really began, I think, with just a series of conversations. I had particularly admired Greg's work on sort of his sort of deconstruction, loving, I thought, deconstructions of the work of Ibsen and Samuel Beckett, which I thought, for me, demonstrated an extraordinary, passionate appreciation, understanding, and even love of these complex artists, but done in a sort of really, you know, quirky, highly original, fantastic way that sort of revealed these writers. And I'm sure, you know, Greg will talk about that more specifically. So I think we just kind of started talking about O'Neill, didn't we? Wasn't that how it began? I just sort of brought you in and said, hey, what do you think about O'Neill?
Yeah, you just were, you're saying, Greg, I want you to look at O'Neill and see what you think. Come up with something that you'd like to do.
I mean, I originally had an idea, frankly, that similar to his piece, which took the last 10 minutes the last 2 minutes of Ibsen's work, and I thought, I mean, I've always been fascinated and in awe of O'Neill's stage directions, which are among the most hilarious, over the top, and brilliantly specific and kind of crazy. I mean, you know, they're just sort of insane, his stage directions. They always have been. He didn't trust actors at all. He hated actors. He didn't really like directors very much. And my first thought was, well, Greg, what about commissioning you in the company to sort of create a piece just about the stage directions? Mm-hmm. And that was an early conversation, which then led us to this play.
Yeah, I'm not an O'Neill scholar, and I kind of turned into an Ibsen scholar as I was working on my Ibsen show, and I have been a Beckett scholar, so I knew what to do with Beckett. But but O'Neill, I mean, I felt like, wow, I felt like the idea would be to do something about the entirety of O'Neill, like I'd done the complete Beckett and the
right.
complete Ibsen. And I just felt really not up to snuff on that. So I started kind of forging my way through O'Neill's plays and hit upon Strange Interlude and just really fell in love with how outrageous and awful in terms of awe-inspiring and preposterous it was. And, I mean, everything was there. I mean, the great thing about working on a nine-act, six-hour play is you've got so much material. You can devote an entire act to a certain concept. I mean, there's so much there that you can play around with. And I knew I wanted to, a lot of the neo-futurist aesthetic is to acknowledge the fact that we are performers on stage giving you a production. And so by including the stage directions, the character descriptions, it had that kind of one-offishness that the neo-futurists are known for. That
one-off?
In a Brechtian way, you see the actors present the characters. Mm-hmm. You don't watch characters come out on stage and empathize or not empathize with the character. It's very much you are identifying with the performer who then presents the piece.
So we all know we're here in a theater. We all know we're doing this together. We're not trying to get fooled, essentially.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, the neo-futurism is very much dedicated to expressing truth on stage in terms of we're all here in the same room and we're all equals and we're going to experience this together. Mm-hmm. So it seemed like Strange Interlude already had this kind of meta-theatrical aspect to it. This is the play that O'Neill thought was a brilliant idea to have all of his characters speak their internal thoughts on stage. Mm-hmm. And so hence the length is about double, well, more than double, the length of a normal play because you hear both what they're actually saying to each other and then you hear their internal thoughts, their asides. Right. And so since that level of alternate reality was already there, I thought it was really part and parcel of what we'd want to do in a neo-futurist production of also adding the level of O'Neill speaking directly through his stage directions and his character descriptions, and then also I always have kind of this level of actuality of the actors commenting on the work and the audience being brought into it and things like that. So I really was turned on by how the hell do you tackle these outrageous asides, which go on and on and on, and you know, immediately I realized, well, to sustain 6 hours, I'm going to have to go at it in lots of different ways, and so part of it, my job was to diversify my approach. And I kind of wound up having a different concept for each act as to how we would present each act.
And that is similar to your Ibsen piece, for instance.
It is, actually, yes, it was. The fifth act, we only did the stage directions and added the three lines, I think, from the text. And I was amazed how much everyone knew exactly what was going on just by the adverbs that O'Neill put out there. And, you know, I mean, I think that's pretty... It's a brilliant playwriting to be able to pull
to
off
stand up to that.
An act by you just pull all the dialogue and it's still there and you know what's going on. So I hit on Strange Interlude and I came.
I was horrified. I was horrified and appalled and also thrilled by you know. I mean, I tried to dissuade Greg initially. I did everything I could.
I mean, even initially, when I said, "Well, what about Strange Interlude?" And Bob said, "Well, I love that play, and it's either Ibsen, either O'Neill's best or his worst."
Yeah, it was amazing that he said to me, you know, I mean, we kind of talked about it originally, and you know, and Greg said, well, let me go away and work on it. Let me read some of these plays. So when he came in and sat down, he said, I want to do Strange Interlude. And my first, I laughed because that is a play that I've actually been obsessed with for like 20 years. I've really been obsessed with it because I think it contains everything that is both great about Eugene O'Neill and everything that is terrible about Eugene O'Neill.
Right.
all in one form. Gigantic package. Yeah. And I could never quite decide. And it's fascinating because in its time, it was his most successful play. It was hugely successful with the audience. It had the longest run of any of his plays in his lifetime on Broadway. It made him the most money. It put him right at the center of pop culture, which I thought was fascinating, at a time when, well, I mean, actually, it's our time. It's inconceivable to think of any playwright or theater artist being aligned with mass pop culture.
I mean, to the point where the Marx Brothers have a very direct allusion to him in Animal Crackers.
Right.
And apparently the audience all knew.
Everybody knew.
Everybody laughed.
Which is amazing.
Yeah, Groucho just stops for a minute and he goes, wait a minute, I think I'm having a strange interlude.
And even refers to Marsden. I mean, it's that specific. Right. It's not even the form. It's like specific allusion to the play.
So it'd be like the equivalent of a current comedy. Mm-hmm. You know, who's the guy who directs every comedy in the world right now? Judd Apatow. You know,
right.
it'd be like stopping a Judd Apatow comedy with Seth Rogen in the middle to make some reference to Tony Kushner on Broadway.
Right. Right.
You know what I mean?
And then everybody laughs.
And everybody would laugh, and everybody would be in a room and know what that was.
Right.
So
right.
It was kind of a. So I've been struggling with this play, and it's a play I have actually thought about directing, because I admire it on so many levels, and I'm also sort of appalled by it and sort of horrified by it because it's. You know, I think O'Neill is a genius, but I think even within genius there is this madness, and so Greg wanting to sort of approach it, I thought was actually incredibly brave, absolutely right, and my initial questions were more like, well, how.
Should we cut it down?
I mean, yeah. First, should we cut it down? Should it be full length? Is it possible actually even to rehearse a play this long with your company? You know, we had those issues. Ultimately, it was a brilliant choice. It was a perfect choice. And I think that it did exactly what I set out, which was it allowed us to look at an artist and a group of artists, including the actors, considerable artists, marvelous actors, who were struggling with a play that you both sort of love and kind of hate and kind of think is ridiculous, but you're also in awe of its obsessive brilliance, you know. And that struggle and being able to see that struggle, I think, is what was so thrilling to the audience. And I do think that for three remarkable performances, the audience was thrilled with the event and actually kind of went through what we went through.
Yeah.
We were kind of horrified, delighted, laughed, gripped, angry.
Yeah, cried. I mean, I think that's...
Yeah.
That's what I was, I think, the most proud of, actually, in the performances, is that the audience really hung on every single moment. And there were times where it was straight O'Neill. We were just literally doing O'Neill's lines verbatim, and the audience would laugh. And it was like, I didn't do that. I mean,
right.
I gave the audience the liberty to laugh by putting some...
But on the other hand, then you were doing O'Neill verbatim in a very straightforward scene, for example, where a man is playing a scene with a doll. Which I thought was very moving, and the audience was totally held and gripped. And there were many moments like that where the audience, I mean, what was wild about it was to hear the audience go from sort of uproarious laughter and appreciation of sort of a comic moment and an ironic moment, and then instantly be held in the grip of a great story.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always think that with great writers, it's sort of silly to get angry at people who deconstruct them or play around with them in some way. Because I always go, you know, Shakespeare is a big boy. Shakespeare can take all sorts of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Ibsen can take it. Strindberg can take it. They can take it. And I think to some extent O'Neill can take it.
I think that people get angry only when, or maybe legitimately get angry when, the deconstruction is disrespectful, is making fun of. And I think...
Well, that's a matter of opinion.
You would disagree with that.
Well, it's hard to draw the line as to what point are you making
exactly.
fun of and what point are you revering it. And I think, you know, my production is doing both.
Well, and that's the heart of my question about it. How do you both make fun of something and express it, be true to it at the same time? And there's... is there anything you can say about your attitude going in? Like, I won't do that, I will do that. Or what keeps it true to the text, even when you're being so wild with it?
I guess for me, what kept it true to the text is that literally 99.5% of every word said on stage was O'Neill. I mean, it was verbatim O'Neill.
Right.
My choice was what to say. I mean, what to include in that spoken dialogue. We start the show with the actors saying their character names, their adverbial stage direction, and then their line, every single line for the first couple acts. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of my distancing elements that I play with in my form of theater. But O'Neill wrote all that, and he took painstaking effort to write this 350-page play with all that stuff in there. And I thought, well, how fascinating would it be to put that out there and have that said for the first time probably ever on stage in a performance and have the audience respond.
And to hear his stage directions, which are sort of essential parts of the work that you rarely pull the curtain back and look at.
Right.
He describes in all of his plays exactly how the actors look. He describes exactly their eyes, the color of their eyes, their height, their mouths, the set of their chins, their weight.
And in Strange Interlude, over the 9 hours, the actors change every single act. They
right.
talk about someone having bags under the eyes and then coming out the next act, you know, two minutes later with trim and, you know, mm-hmm. it's all over the place.
Can you quote one of the, you know, a prime example of the kind of thing that you're talking about?
Well, yes, there's one very specific Marsden reference.
Yeah,
that's...
yeah, which is... Marsden has a feminine quality about him which is not apparent in either appearance or act.
It's aura.
And it's like, yeah, I mean, and so...
So what do we do with that?
Exactly. You go, how do you play that?
How do you
right.
play that? And it's often like there's an overwhelming sense of this, but they're hiding it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's not even apparent. It happens a number... There are three different... major character descriptions that are like that. Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, he talks about their eyes and their face and their, you know, so that there's no way you could possibly cast an actor who would be able
would
to do all
these
right.
things.
Right, yeah.
Right.
So, you know, as preposterous as that was, I also loved that. I mean, it was mm-hmm. so
yeah.
great. So specific.
And so allowing the audience, I think, for the first time in a production to hear that, as well as the device which O'Neill was experimenting with. I mean, it was an experiment. I think, you know, he was very influenced mm-hmm. by modernism. I think he was very influenced perhaps by you know, Gertrude Stein and by James Joyce and Virginia Woolf and certainly Freud. Mm-hmm. And he was trying to create, I think, the Freud is extraordinary, but he was trying to create on stage a new kind of theater that was like a novel, where a character could be in the play but also have a sort of first-person narrative sense of the novel, that we could go inside their heads. So he was experimenting with something. I think he was a highly experimental artist.
How different is it from a Shakespearean soliloquy? I mean, that idea isn't new at all.
That's very true. I mean, also, if you read the asides in Strange Interlude, there's an innate comic sense to them because mm-hmm. you see the contrast so much more. I mean, I think what O'Neill was shooting for was how people's face, how
right.
people's appearance would be one way, but their thoughts were completely
He was obsessed in this period of time also with the idea of the mask. He was obsessed with the idea that the face could do one thing, but was thinking something else. Mm-hmm. So he was really trying to sort of rip off manners, and it was deliberately comic, and I think I'm sure in its time there were an extraordinary number of laughs, because you just couldn't help get laughs when you hear a character say, you know, thank you very much, I'm delighted to be here, and then, no, I hate being here, I hate this person, I hate everything about this experience, why did I come here, why am I doing this?
And that whole kind of facade element really struck me very personally. I mean, that's something I've always explored in all my work, is the difference between how we present ourselves in a social instance and yet how we are actually feeling and thinking mm-hmm. inside, mm-hmm. growing up on the north side of Chicago and all the inhibitions of the North Shore. I very much connected on that level as well.
Well, so many avenues we could pursue from all that. I mean, one is the avant-garde, and how does it weather? A lot of what I think people find problematic now in these plays is the stuff that was so cool and kind of mind-blowing then, because these ideas were new. You know, Freud, these were all new ideas. And now to us, we're kind of like, oh, we know all that. So then what... I mean, I know that part of your impulse in all of this was to figure out, well, what do we do? Because there's still such great stuff here, but there's also this dated, clunky stuff that a modern audience can't respond to in the same way.
Well, I think that's absolutely true, and I think that was the whole festival, really. I mean, I chose to sort of focus on O'Neill's middle plays. I mean, we really know O'Neill mostly through his late real masterpieces that are predominantly personal, realistic works.
Right.
Long Day's Journey Into Night, Moon for the Misbegotten. And my theory has always been that, O'Neill had sort of the misfortune of having these, and the fortune of having these late plays produced at exactly the time in America when we were obsessed with realism and Lee Strasberg and method acting. And I think that the same misfortune happened to the plays of Tennessee Williams, for example.
They lose their metaphorical.
And I think Tennessee Williams is really a highly perverse, provocative poet, mm-hmm. as much as anything else. Yeah. And his works, I think, generally were very, very flattened out by their initial productions, many of them in the 1950s and the 1960s, mm-hmm. and that there's something much more of a provocateur and a sort of visionary poet in his work. And I think similarly with O'Neill, we don't know his middle plays and his early plays, which were avant-garde. He was very much a member of the New York avant-garde, politically, socially, aesthetically, and in every way. And we forget that now. We totally forget that. These plays were banned. Actors were arrested. They were licentious. They were dirty. They were politically radical. Mm-hmm. They created quite the ruckus. And so my job, I thought, as curator was, how do you recreate that for a contemporary audience? How do you get an audience feeling the same thing in complete respect for O'Neill, to restore his plays to, I think, the radical perspective that they once had? And I think that happened for every single director who was working in this festival, was mm-hmm. trying to take a work and provoke, you know, an audience. I think Liz LeCompte, I think Garoli, I think Ivo Van Hove.
The Brazilians specifically, I definitely, when I was watching those plays, kept thinking, wow, this play would just not work unless this director had been so brilliant with how he conceived of each mm-hmm. one, very individually,
yeah.
too.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the Brazilians' work was just spectacular. And yet, at the same time, I had no interest in either staging. I mean, I couldn't imagine a straight production of any of those plays. And something about their authenticity coming from Brazil and their language and the
poetry of the movement and the poetry of the faces. To some extent, it was almost better, you know, I think, seeing that play in Portuguese.
It was.
Yeah. Rather than hearing it in English.
Distracted by the, yeah.
Well,
the dialogue.
To some extent, you weren't distracted by the dialogue. So to see the plays in Portuguese mm-hmm. and to see the faces of these actors and to see this company and to see the director's sort of attention to minute detail of movement and sound and music and lighting was very moving, you know.
But now, I mean, to play devil's advocate, what I could characterize what you've both just said is that the plays only work if an auteur comes in, a director comes in, and makes something that's so different from what O'Neill made that it almost isn't O'Neill anymore. And that's certainly the source of what has made some audience members angry about these productions, right?
Yeah.
So what's your answer to that? I mean, does O'Neill hold up or not hold up if it requires this much intervention from the director?
I don't think any of the directors... I mean, I would say Liz LeCompte went the furthest in
yeah.
terms of interpreting Emperor Jones in this case. But I think all of the directors definitely said, okay, I'm doing this play because I love this play.
Yes.
But I'm going to make it in my own interpretation. Obviously.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I love Strange Interlude. I was accused of hating O'Neill. But I think it's a really, really wonderful play.
Why don't you just quickly tell what happened at the performance?
Opening night, the lights came up at the intermission, the first intermission of three, and some man from the balcony, the mezzanine, stood up, very big man in front row, said... something about you. Why are you butchering this beautiful play?
Right.
This is a travesty. This sucks. Very loudly. And everyone was like, huh?
Whoa.
Oh, that's interesting. And then, surprisingly, the next night, yet someone else stood up front row center, stormed out. I thought he had to go to the bathroom or was feeling ill or something. Just right before the end of the second act and right before that first intermission. And so he kind of got up and stormed off very quickly, and he was a fairly elderly man. And but then I heard from the back of the house him saying, "This is terrible. You don't know how to do O'Neill," something
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
So
There were certainly people who
and that guy, you know, identified himself by name on Chris Jones's blog very proudly, saying, look, I love O'Neill. I've come to all these O'Neill plays, and this was a disaster. This was a travesty. Mm-hmm. This took it too far. Greg Allen is a fraud. You know, what's been interesting is, yeah, there have been, it's been kind of interesting and you know, lively, actually, to see on the internet in particular and in print in some of the newspapers.
Some guy called me at the theater yesterday, too.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, specifically saying, well, why did you have the actors speak the adverbs? What were you thinking? You know, and this, I mean, he actually put forth these questions, so I wasn't quite sure whether he was, you know, pro
really
or con or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Well, at the end, I kind of said, I hope you enjoyed the show. No, I didn't. I didn't at all. I walked out. And it's like, well, then I talked to him about that.
Yeah.
He sat through Emperor Jones. He loved Desire Under the Elms. I mean, he thought both of those were fascinating, but something about Strange Generals.
Well, that's
went
what
over his line.
That's what was fascinating to me was I don't think a theater experience is a particularly good experience if it gets a generic response from an audience. And I think a generic response is, boy, that was good. I loved it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's sort of, you know, a lot of crap. From hamburgers to number one rated TV shows, a lot of people love. It doesn't mean it's good. So the fact is that I'd hoped that there would be controversy. I'd hoped that there would be a dialogue. I wanted to provoke a dialogue. I think theater is only exciting if there is a dialogue. And what's been remarkable to me has been the extent and the breadth of a dialogue. And you go to blog sites, you go to the internet, you look in the newspapers, this dead white man created an extraordinary controversy in the city for 2.5 months, you know, and I think that's fantastic.
Let me push back, because O'Neill, most of the people who are annoyed because they revere O'Neill and they perceive some of these productions as being disrespectful or something, which is different from O'Neill himself engendering controversy because of the ideas in the play, right?
No, I don't think that's completely true. No? I think that all the directors were trying to honor the ideas in the play that themselves were controversial. I mean,
still controversial?
Oh, absolutely. Like, yeah. I think to try to produce a production of the Emperor Jones.
Yeah.
These are plays that are attacks, and they are explorations of racism, capitalism, patriarchy, sexism, science, religion.
Things that still matter.
Sexuality.
Yeah.
All of these things matter. But I honestly think that dust needs to get blown off of most classics. And that's how I approach it. People say this is a conversation I have every time I work on a Shakespeare play. Can't Shakespeare speak for himself?
No.
And I go, no, actually, I don't think he can. And I get really tired and angry with people sort of assuming that you know, I'm fucking with Shakespeare, other people are fucking with Shakespeare, and that Shakespeare can somehow work on his own. I don't think so. I want to see Shakespeare interpreted by a director and a group of actors. I want to see Shakespeare shoved in my face in the 21st century and made sense of it.
The idea that you can do anything according to the playwright's wishes is preposterous to me as well. I mean, how do we know their intent? There's no way of knowing that. And
of course, that's a difference dealing with a dead playwright as opposed to, for instance, Albee or Mamet.
I'm totally talking about different. I'm talking about dead writers.
Right.
I mean, we don't know Ibsen, Shakespeare, Chekhov, O'Neill, Brecht.
But even if we did, the audience is irrevocably different. You cannot.
Exactly.
We can't hear it the way their audiences were intended to hear it, because
we're
so different.
Well, and that was one of the things that really intrigued me, was like putting O'Neill out there, putting Strange Interlude out there so that the audience could respond however they wished. I mean, the things that kind of really got me when I was reading the play was, oh my God, she has an abortion because her mother-in-law says there's madness in the family. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, those things were still just gut-wrenching. It's horrifying.
Mm-hmm.
And when you really get down to those issues are like outrageous. And there were so many jaw-dropping moments in the script and the plot of Strange Interlude that really turned me on to it's like, wow, this really sustains itself as a story.
Yeah.
But surrounding that is a lot of things that are somewhat dated and kind of misogynistic and you know, kind of ridiculous and Freudian and all these other elements as well that are either brilliant or kind of ridiculous. And I wanted to put all those things out there.
I mean, it's interesting, but it's a great discussion because I'm trying to say is I think Greg and I and all the artists that made these plays greatly respect these plays, yeah. love these plays, yeah. are passionate. That's why we devoted our lives for a period of time to doing these plays. And I also respect the idea of, and I'm not actually even trying to dismiss an audience member who has problems with these plays. I think they should have problems with the productions. Mm-hmm. They should argue with the plays, and they should argue with the interpretations. I think that's great.
I was thrilled.
So I actually am thrilled with, you know, the responses of the audience to all of these plays, because I mean, look, there was a significant controversy surrounding, you know, and we go back 3.5, you know, not 3.5 months, however many months it was, 2 months ago, opening night of this festival, you know, was surrounding the Emperor Jones, which presents the image of a, you know, Caucasian woman in blackface, doing a sort of exaggerated Amos and Andy shuffle and jive
in kabuki style.
This was not a safe choice.
Oh my gosh, it's so out there, and, yeah. and doing every single word of O'Neill's text as he wrote it, mm-hmm. and it was very controversial and dangerously so. Meaning there were particularly African Americans who wrote us, who called us, who said, "You cannot do this play. Mm-hmm. You cannot do this representation of an African American on your stage. It is offensive and it is destructive. It is evil." Mm-hmm. And those were words that were used. And it's very, very powerful words. And this play and this production provoked very, very powerful controversy, which I thought was legitimate because I think the play is a dangerous play. And I thought the production was an extremely dangerous production. And that, to me, is the excitement that can only happen in the theater. The excitement of seeing Greg's production was that you could only experience that moment in the theater collectively for 6 hours.
The thing is, it's easy to be controversial. It's easy to screw around with something and do something outrageous.
No, I don't think that's true.
Well, but let me say the rest of it, and then you can respond.
Okay.
But what's hard, it seems to me, is to do something like that and at the same time do something good. In other words, it's not enough. You can't, if you just set out to be controversial, that doesn't seem like a worthwhile enterprise.
Well, I think that's true, and I think that anybody just sets out to be controversial I don't think anybody sets out originally to be a provocateur. I don't think any one of the artists working on this play as an interpretive artist set out to say, "I am deliberately trying to provoke."
Piss off my audience. That'll be fun.
It never occurred to
me. I think every artist approached this play saying, "I love this play. I think this play is a dangerous play, mm-hmm. for certain reasons. And how do I present this play to an audience in the most exciting way, mm-hmm. to honor a provocative playwright?"
Right.
That's how I think. I think that every director in every production was significantly different. And what I think we discovered was that the vast majority of the audience was tremendously excited by the experience. Mm-hmm. When I say the vast majority, I mean 95% of the audience was thrilled.
Yeah.
And I think maybe 5%, maybe it was higher, was horrified or shocked or upset or angry.
But it provoked a
response. That is a provocative response that I think is completely legitimate and exciting and great.
Mm-hmm. And very parallel to, for instance, how Strange Interludes started off. I mean, it was banned and kicked out of Boston, and everyone flocked out to the burbs to see it. And you know, it was dealing with abortion. It was dealing with,
a lot of taboos.
Religion and sex lots of taboos at the time. And I'm sure people shouted at the stage and stormed off. And it never occurred to me that would occur here in 2009.
I mean, yeah. What happens? How does a performance change when the audience is divided? When it's not everybody sitting there, "Oh, yeah, this is pretty good, I'm okay," versus some people just absolutely lifted and enthralled, and some people crossing their arms and just dying to give you a sock in the mouth. Mm-hmm. Does that affect how the actors feel as they're doing the performance? Can you feel it in the room?
On opening, I heard from my stage manager that the actors were really psyched, that it really, I mean, my feeling was the two nights it happened, two-thirds of my run, someone stood up and shouted at the stage. that it really galvanized the audience. I mean, it kind of divided the audience into the purists who were feeling like this, you can't do this with O'Neill. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be done straight. It's a very tragic show.
Right.
And the other people who were just eating it up. I mean, just saying, wow, this is really great. Mm-hmm. And so I think it kind of made people take a stand in that capacity. And the artists on stage, the performers were also kind of like, wow, this is really exciting.
You know, it's interesting how we, you know, I'll talk for a second about a reversal challenge, which was true, like on my cast. I mean, I had my own very delicate cast of particularly three actors doing Desire Under the Elms, which is a very difficult show to perform, extraordinarily difficult, because it requires that the actors enter into a realm of obsessive, sexual, romantic on one hand, but also Freudian, disastrous feelings towards each other. Right. I mean, you know, ultimately the centerpiece scene of Desire Under the Elms is a very ambitious young woman seducing a younger man, a boy really, into a sexual relationship by becoming his dead mother. Mm-hmm. That she's been unsuccessful in her attempts to seduce him with her own sexuality. So what she does is realize that he is mother-obsessed, that he's desperate for the love of a mother. So she becomes his mother, which allows them to have sex with each other. And that is very complex and extraordinarily delicate. And it's written, as is all of O'Neill, on the edge of ludicrousness.
Yeah.
Meaning he, and that's what I love about O'Neill, is that he is so unironic. He's so out there, and he's so desperately sort of truthful in what he's doing that it actually becomes embarrassing for an audience to, and his purity of emotion is so embarrassing that it's very difficult for the actors to go there, and it's difficult for the audiences to go there. So I had sort of an opposite thing with Greg, where I had to avoid laughs. And my actors would get very, very sensitive on stage if they felt the audience laughing
like
at them.
Titter.
Mm-hmm. They're laughing at me. I am trying to expose my innermost, deepest feelings, which are so vulnerable, and I can feel the audience beginning to laugh. Mm-hmm. And I had to sort of work a fine line, and there were some times where I had to sort of work with the actors to cut. I cut some lines that just sent the audience over into laughter, and at other times I had to let the actors understand that it was not necessarily that they were being laughed at, that there was a. It was the danger again
the
of the play.
Yeah.
The danger of the play made the audience nervous,
and an audience's
response is to laugh to release that tension. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I'm proudest of actually was I thought in a unusually articulate review for a critic, the New York Times mentioned that scene and talked about that scene and said the scene was so dangerous that just when you were starting to get the giggles as an audience member, the actors would dig in so deep that it would wipe the smirk off the audience's face. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was true. That was exactly what was going on. And that was exactly what we were dealing with, was the actors could feel the audience's nervousness. And rather than going with it, which was Greg's approach, was going with it and allowing it and giving the audience full license to laugh in a sort of appreciation of ludicrous. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying ludicrous in a bad way. I'm talking about it being kind of wonderful, that it's so full, it's so rich, it's so over the top, it's so true, that Greg allowed them to laugh. In my production, I had to find a way to keep them from laughing in order to keep the energy of the play moving through. Mm-hmm. Do you see what I'm saying?
Where I actually cut things that were funny as well, because I wanted to keep a certain section more serious. And then I was amazed by the end of the show, I could throw in a line that was absolutely ridiculous in a very serious moment, and people would laugh and then come straight back to the tragedy.
So I think that this is an example, for example, of two directors where you just can't say, oh, let O'Neill speak for himself. You just can't do it. Mm-hmm. Meaning I, you know, in a far more conservative production, working with this text, I had to make cuts. I had to do some editing. I had to reshape a little bit. Mm-hmm. I had to sort of, because I believe in the work, and I think it is a real tragedy. I think it is a work that is actually the first great tragedy ever written by an American who is trying to sort of touch the gods, literally. O'Neill was trying to be Euripides or Sophocles. Mm-hmm. And he saw himself as the heir to those two. And he knew that he knew he wasn't touching the gods, but he was going to die trying. He wanted to create an American tragedy. And I think he did. But I think in order for that tragedy to have the same power that O'Neill was trying to get in 1925,
you have to adjust.
There's adjustments that a cast and a director and a designer need to make.
I mean, it's true with Shakespeare, too. You can't play some of that wordplay or, you know, some of the verbal comedy. And Shakespeare's just not funny anymore. You have to do something about it. That doesn't mean that Shakespeare wasn't great or that you're not being true to the play, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that these plays, I mean, that's, you know, you can't trust a 400-year-old play to sort of work. I know that sounds weird, but we are a different culture. We're a different time. The words have lost meaning.
And you
need somebody to sort of be a sort of go between the audience and the work. And that person is generally a director.
Who brings them closer together.
There's a whole
museum pieces anyway. I mean, the idea, I mean, actually, I went to East Berlin when the wall was still up, and I went over to the Berliner Ensemble and saw Three Penny Opera, which had obviously not been touched in decades. Mm-hmm. It was presented exactly as it had been historically. And it was pretty dead theater.
Yeah.
I mean, it just didn't work. And I was so excited. Wow, the Berliner Ensemble doing Brecht.
See, right?
And you know, it's just like old films often. If you watch the film, it's not a contemporary
event. I think
event.
That's a great example.
It has
to
be a contemporary event.
I mean, Brecht, who was a radical in his time, all of his conventions and all of the sort of more radical aesthetics of Brecht have been completely absorbed into television comedies, Broadway musicals, the mainstream.
MTV.
Yeah. So if you're trying to sort of honor, say, a play by Brecht, you need to honor it by finding new ways of presenting
having
it.
That same reaction.
And I think that is the same. And I mean, Shakespeare is our great lesson, and that's why Shakespeare continues to live, because, yes, he's the greatest writer in the English language. There's no doubt he's the greatest dramatist to have ever created work. But the works do not speak for themselves. One has to sort of, I believe, interpret and be a go-between. And I think that we have to do that as well with O'Neill. And I think that's what's made this festival, or at least this particular festival, which put that aesthetic first and foremost up front. And that's very different than saying, let's honor Edward Albee and David Mamet, who happen to be probably the two most persnickety playwrights in the world today.
Since Beckett is dead.
Well, since Beckett is dead. And Beckett continues to be persnickety from the grave.
From the grave.
He really does, like appallingly so. I think Beckett continues to sort of try to control how his productions are done from the grave. I think there may very well come a time with Beckett, I think there has come a time with Beckett, and with Mamet and Albee in many generations later, where people are going to need more freedom in terms of interpreting them, to sort of honor them.
Yeah. Well, we're way over time. There's one other thing I did want to...
And not one thing you can cut. This has been such a fascinating conversation. It's virtually uncuttable.
I would like to talk about what does a festival format allow that an individual production does not? And, I mean, there's an obvious first answer that I just have to supply, which is that Greg would not have directed this play.
No.
And obviously that by itself I think is probably an accomplishment that Bob should feel proud of. But what else... does a festival allow, or what other challenges does it create?
I love the resonance that festivals create, where actually we have an allusion to Desire Under the Elms in Strange Interlude.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, I was kind of interested in including an allusion to all of the other productions in the festival. Also being the closer was quite wonderful. We had
to sum up.
We had one allusion to Californiae in Strange Interlude, and a bunch of the audience, you know, laughed with recognition that they'd all seen that in Desire Under the Elms. I think festival atmosphere is awesome, that the audience comes and really studies one thing for a long period of time, and it creates more of a community in the audience, which I think all good theater does. And people can compare and contrast and discuss with knowledge and study one particular playwright in this case.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, of course, from my perspective, as you said, there's no way in a million years I would have done Strange Interlude without this opportunity.
I think it's interesting. It's a great question. And I think that all of these productions had the potential to be successful outside of a festival setting, but I think a festival setting really allowed them to be looked at as a body of work. And I think that one of the reasons, whether we realized it or not, I didn't quite, you know, it wasn't, the festival wasn't set up, the order with which, it turned out to be the perfect order for the plays to appear in, I think, which wasn't deliberate, I have to say.
Claim credit.
I wish I could, but it just turned out to be scheduling more than anything else sort of drove it. But I think that Greg's 6 hours in the theater was the joyous, thrilling response, quite triumphant, really, from an audience that had sat through 6 hours of this particular O'Neill play, was also matched by many audience members who had sat through 7 other plays by Eugene O'Neill. I think a good portion of them in that audience had been through all of them. So some hadn't, but some had. So in a way, it was also a celebration that we'd gotten through this entire festival. I know that Ivo van Hove, who directed The Morning Becomes Electra, was terrified of bringing this production to the United States, and he never would have thought anybody would have wanted it. He thought this was one of his more severe productions, his more personal productions, his more violent productions in terms of sexuality, language, emotional violence. He and his company were terrified. And he was just couldn't believe the response that he received, both critically and from the audience. Now, I have to say, I think it's a brilliant production that could very well stand up on its own. But I do think the fact that it was being seen in the context of a festival and that the audience that came to see it had read about it, thought about it, and seen other works by Eugene O'Neill that had a similar sort of aesthetic of exploration and experimentation meant that they could fully embrace Morning Becomes Electra.
Do you think that if you had it to do again, you would do anything different in terms of marketing so that those people who were offended would have known what they were getting into before they came in?
Oh, no. They all knew what they were. I mean, unless they were complete morons, which I don't believe. I mean, there was somebody on the blog. I did read one blog person about Stranger in a Loo who said, and they hated it, and I think they left. And they said something like, I didn't know anything about this festival. Mm. I was in town. I knew that the Goodman was a Tony Award-winning resident theater.
Right.
I paid my money to see a Eugene O'Neill play. And boy, was I upset.
Right.
Now, I think that was a rare individual. And I think that, for the most part, we did a pretty fantastic job of setting the context for what these works were going to be about. Mm-hmm. And I think even poor Bernie, the guy who stormed, poor bald Bernie, who sort of stormed out of, I say poor bald Bernie because, you know, you couldn't miss it. It was in the front row. Everybody,
right.
It was so much part of the show. And Bernie out there proudly is part of the sort of, you know, anti-strange interlude clack.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's having a great time identifying himself and saying, I stormed out.
Right.
And it's sort of an ongoing thing. And God bless him for it. You know, he's an engaged theatergoer. He really is. He's an engaged and, I think, informed theatergoer mm-hmm. who knows what he likes, doesn't like other things, isn't shy about saying it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of great. So that controversy to me was a minimal part of this festival. I think discussion and interreaction was a major part of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just want to end by quoting also from the blogs. Someone who was clearly part of that 95% on The Strange Interlude. And this is from a blog called Theatter. It's Benedict Nelson, who's a writer I really admire. I don't know if you've seen this one.
I don't know. He said,
this was the best production I've ever seen of anything. It was 5 hours of performance, and it was totally flawless. The perfect conspiracy of storytelling acted with meticulous alchemy and embodied with such big-hearted, open-armed precision that if it weren't so utterly gleefully earthbound, its soaring comic genius would have embraced the whole audience and lifted us into the sky.
Can't beat that.
He's a really smart guy.
You know, David Mamet once told me there was only one kind of review that was acceptable to him. And I said, well, what is that, Dave? And he said, I've seen it, now I can die.
Well, Greg just got his, so thank you both so much.
Thanks,
and
that was great. We'll be right back.
Hello, Chicago, and welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, bringing you the theater news for the week of March 16th, 2009. The Goodman Theater has announced their 2009-2010 season, and the season also includes the 32nd annual production of the holiday favorite, A Christmas Carol, beginning in November. The 2009-2010 season includes, in the Albert Theater, Animal Crackers by George S. Kaufman and Mari Riskind, Huey by Eugene O'Neill, this one will be directed by Robert Falls, Crap's Last Tape by Samuel Beckett, A True History of the Johnstown Flood by Rebecca Gilman, and The Sins of Sor Juana by Karen Zacharias. In the Owen Theater, you can see Joan d'Arc, directed by Aida Carrick, High Holidays by Alan Gross, and The Long Red Road by Brett C. Leonard. And this one will be directed by film actor Philip Seymour Hoffman. Subscription season tickets are currently available. For more information, click on over to Talk Theater in Chicago's Theater News website. Get ready for some theater tidbits. The Silk Road Theater Project begins its 2009 season with the Midwest premiere of Pangs of the Messiah by Israeli playwright Moti Lerner. The production will start on March 19th. In light of the recent spat of gloomy weather, and not to mention the country's even gloomier finances, Don't Dress for Dinner at the Royal George Theater is doing a pay-what-you-can ticket price for two performances only of the hit comedy. Those performances will be this Wednesday evening, March 18th, and April 15th, tax day. Audiences can pay whatever price they'd like, however, the minimum price will be $1 a ticket. Local PBS WTTW 11 Chicago will air the Backstage with Mary Poppins program on this Tuesday at 8 o'clock. The series is hosted by NPR's Scott Simon and it explores the creation of this magical Disney musical that's set to hit the Chicago stage. Chicago Shakespeare Theater welcomes Second City to Navy Pier with a limited six-week engagement of their smash hit, Rod Blagojevich Superstar. That will run from March 26th through May 3rd at Chicago Shakespeare's Upstairs Theater. Lifeline Theater Artistic Director Dorothy Milne has announced their 27th anniversary season of presenting big stories up close. The season will feature five popular books on stage and one original play. Get more details on these stories and more information on our Theater in Chicago news website. Broadway in Chicago has announced that Mary Poppins will be extending its stay at the Cadillac Palace Theater. It will be extended from May 20th through July 12th. In addition, Mary Poppins will also have a special Sunday evening performance at 6:30. The North American National Tour of Mary Poppins opens on March 25th with the two original Broadway stars, Ashley Brown as Mary Poppins and Gavin Lee as Bert. Mary Poppins is a co-production by Disney and Cameron McIntosh. It is based on the P.L. Travers stories and the classic 1964 Walt Disney film. The tour will later make its Australian debut at the Capitol Theatre in Sydney next October. Tickets for Mary Poppins are available, so follow the links on our website in the most delightful way. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. Remember, you can find us here every Monday with more news ready for you to enjoy. So, until next Monday, that is the theater news from Talk Theater in Chicago, and I'm your host, Dustin Moat. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. I would like to thank Robert Falls and Greg Allen for giving us the honor of interviewing them this week. I would also like to thank Mark Meyer. Without him, this podcast would not be possible. And also, I would like to thank you, our listening audience. Remember, we will be here every Monday with a new episode ready for your listening pleasure. So, until next Monday, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you, Chicago, to keep talking theater.